Hello, this is Dan Le Batard, and we continue to ask you to rate, subscribe, and review. Thank you for supporting what it is that we're doing around here. We are trying to create a lot more content for you that is free and interesting and different and offer you some menu items here for those of you who like what we do but only like parts of it. You can choose what you want. Many of you like our guest this week, Dominique Foxworth. He's come into our lives. We all love him. He's a genuinely decent soul. His story's interesting from a football perspective, but that's not the reason that I'm interested in him. I find him fascinating because his path is unlike any I've seen, where he gets to the top 1% of the 1% by getting to professional football, and then his next choice after that is Harvard Business School. And while he was in the league, he was running the NFL Players Union, and he's sitting across from Jerry Jones, and he's realizing, this man is not smarter than I am. I can do this. And then he becomes the head financial guy for the NBA Players Union. These are big, prestigious jobs, but he wasn't happy. And so he chose this, the gas bagging path. He left all of that behind, these monster successes. So I'd like to talk to him about that. But first, I got to tell you about ZipRecruiter. And this is a sponsor we are asking you to support because they support us. Mike's got some bullet points here. I see him right here.
You see him.
You were very happy. You weren't listening to me before. You didn't care what I was saying about how interesting Dominique Foxworth is. You just wanted to get to the ZipRecruiter ad.
Oh, damn, because you know hiring is so challenging, but there's one place where you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart.
What's the one place, Mike?
It's ZipRecruiter.com/beach. That's B-E-A-C-H, ZipRecruiter.com/beach. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invite them to apply to your job. And as the applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one of those resumes and spotlights them and the top candidates so you never miss a great match.
Never?
And never. Never, ever miss a great match. And right now, our listeners of South Beach Sessions, they can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/beach. Once again, ZipRecruiter.com/B-E-A-C-H. ZipRecruiter, it's the smartest way to hire.
So again, support the people who support us. That doesn't cost you anything. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/beach. You could do that for us. Just check it out. It'll take you 5 seconds, and you can continue to support the stuff we're doing around here. One of the things we're doing is talking to Dominique Foxworth now. So Dominique has become a friend of the show over the last few years. And weirdly, Dominique, and I don't think that I've had this happen before. I've developed friendships with people that I've covered in sports before, but never after they had played. So I know next to nothing about your career. I know you went to Maryland, and I know that you made money in the league, but I don't know how you got good or what your path was.
Career wasn't that impressive. I mean, I'm not here in the way that Charles Woodson or Randy Moss or even Matt Hasselbeck is here because they were great football players. I was a good football player, but I think I just look at things differently, and I think that's why I'm here. It's not because I was great, and it's not a career that anyone should know necessarily.
No, but hold on a second. You were a professional football player for how many years?
7.
All right, so you get to the league, and you had how many contracts that were substantive that helped pay for, you know, your future?
One that was substantive, yeah. I had my first rookie contract, which is a good amount of money, but it's not, like, life-changing. You still got to work after that, and then I was a free agent. I got traded down to Atlanta on the day before the start of my contract year, which was, like, stressful and scary because I was going down to Atlanta. We had a rookie quarterback, and I just thought we were going to suck, and I was going to be on a terrible team and then become a free agent, and no one would want me, but Matt Ryan showed up. We happened to be really good. I had probably the best season of my career and became a free agent, signed in Baltimore and went back home and imagined a future where I like led my hometown team to a Super Bowl. And after my first season, I tore my ACL and then my priorities shifted and it just wasn't the way that I hoped. But I think things worked out well in the long run.
Well, hold on a second. So you achieve your lifelong dream of getting to professional football. And what level of satisfaction was it?
Not much, honestly. I mean, there's some pride when you can walk around with your chest out and say you've done it, but it's not what you imagine. And I think most people can probably relate to this no matter what career.
It's not what you dreamed.
Yeah.
It's not, once you got there, you realize it's a business. It's not about,
right.
It's not the playground stuff, that it's cold.
Yeah, I think that was it. At every step of the way, I think it was my freshman year. I was redshirting my whole freshman year at Maryland, and then they burned my redshirt because the corners weren't playing well, and I started. My first game was a Thursday night primetime game. We had to beat Clemson to win the ACC championship, and that was my first start. And then I played really well. I played the game, and then we won, and we went and got blown out in the Orange Bowl by Florida. Then after the season, our coach was getting interviews for NFL jobs. And I remember he showed up in a brand new Cadillac, and all the coaches had new Cadillacs. And that was like the first time when I was like, oh, you guys just made a ton of money off of this. Coach signed an extension. And that was the first time when I was like, all right, football, the game of football has died a little to me. And I think it was every step of the way, something else happened and got gradual and more gradual before eventually when I was in Baltimore, I was like, this is work. Parts of it, like, it's really cool work. It's not something I can complain about. This is work. While I was playing in the league was when the concussion stuff started to become more and more evident. So this is work. It's not fun. It's not all it's cracked up to be. I am potentially giving up quality of life in my future. And I was like, I don't want to do this anymore. And so that was that. And then I went to business school.
That is fairly amazing to consider, though, the idea that the further away you got from not being paid, the closer and the more money you got, the further away you got from fun and loving what it is. Whatever love of the sport that you had was totally contaminated by all of the business dealings where you realized that you were a bit of a prostitute, selling your body so that others could make money off it.
A bit of a prostitute. It's a complete prostitute. A very good one, I might add. However, I mean, it wasn't even saying that. So the money complicated things, but it didn't take out the things that I loved about football. The things that I loved about football, the chess game of it, the complexity of it, the relationships of it, the locker room of it, like all of that stuff was still there. Like I feel as strongly about some of my NFL teammates as I did about my Pop Warner.
All that stuff will never be recreated, right? You will find no environment in life and family, anything that feels the way that stuff did.
No. And it's fine. I think one of the prices that I paid that I didn't realize I was paying at the time was giving up a lot of that relationship stuff. So like my wife has friends that she's been tight with since she was in second grade. My wife went to private school as a kid and all her friends went on to be lawyers. She went to law school and like all that happened. I went to public school in Baltimore and my closest friends did not go the route that I went to. They didn't go to colleges. They didn't play football and I lost those connections. I'll never have them back. Same thing in college. Like I became close with my college friends, but we were all there to get to the next level. We went there, we went other places, and then I go to play NFL football in three separate cities. It's hard to build relationships in that way. And recently, after I retired, my wife wanted to have a party, and she's inviting all of her friends. And I'm like, all my friends are like in the last 3 to 4 years. I don't really have friends from when I was a kid. It's a trade that I was making that I didn't know I was making. And it may not be true for everyone, but
Well, we just talked to Doug Baldwin a while ago about the idea of once upon a time, he decided in order to get to the highest levels of my dream, I have to get rid of all of my meaningful relationships. I have to concentrate on this thing because I'm not talented enough to just have it come easy to me. Your path was similar in that regard. But then I asked him, are you still like that? And he's like, no, it took a woman to show me how selfish I was being and that I didn't have perspective about what life is. I took a wife to make me fall in love.
Either you're like that or you're not. And so, like, I feel like it's something that I've worked on. And one of my motivations before going to business school is like a joke I would say is like, I'm going to take this X amount of millions I have and I want to turn it into hundreds of millions. Like, that's why I'm going to go to business school. Then I got there and realized that wasn't what motivated me, but there's still some competitive drive in me. And it's an interesting dynamic where I've succeeded because of that and I welcome it, but it's also like it's corrosive. and it is the reason why you don't have the relationships. And it's the reason why you can sometimes walk into a situation with people that want to be your friend and you view them as competitors and it's not healthy.
Have you realized with age that being competitive isn't necessarily a virtue?
Absolutely. I mean,
it was your lifeblood when it was your between what, 12 years old and
6.
Okay. 6 years old to when competition and being competitive and being better than others, that was a virtue until when?
I'd say until 2013, maybe. Like, I think that's what, so like, you give me a lot of credit and you brag about me to other people, the fact that I went to like a top tier business school. But I didn't go to that top tier business school because I wanted to go to top tier business school. I wanted to go there because I wanted to be able to say I'm better than everyone else. And that's like a weird thing to not be able to have difficulty sussing through the things that you actually want or the things that you want in order to look a certain way or in order to be better than other people. It's based in insecurity, which is a thing that all of us, I think all people can relate to and have to work towards.
Well, but I find interesting that you arrive at your dream jobs and then upon arriving at these jobs of what you thought you were supposed to be as a man, as a black man, however it is that you're viewing yourself, and you're now choosing these very challenging paths to conquer that you get to the top of both of them because you can minimize how good you were at these things. You were a professional football player. It's tough to make a multi-million dollar salary in that sport. Very few people can do it. And then you go into business in a way that has you running two major organizations, their finances. That's how good you are at it. And none of it is satisfying to you. None of it feels rewarding. Much of it makes you unhappy.
It's the, I think, hedonic treadmill is what it is called, but it is also just the life of a football player. You go and you build up because you want to win this game on Sunday. You win the game on Monday, it's forgotten and you move on. You're never satisfied. Again, I'm not sure that it's exclusive to football, but that's the way that I learned. And that's the way in my formative years, that's how I was thinking. It was like, all right, that's over. Move on. I got to get to the next thing. I got to be the best player on my team. I got to be the best player in the state. I got to get a scholarship. And once you get to those things, I remember when I was drafted and I expected to feel it was in the third round. So it wasn't like it was number one overall, but I expected to feel joy. I expected to feel relief at least. I didn't feel any of that. I felt, all right, let's get here and get to work. And I flew out to get to Denver the next day and I was like, all right, I gotta get a job. I gotta get a starting job. It was more focused than at no point did I feel like.
You don't really have time for introspection when you're chasing something with this kind of competitive zeal, right? Your self-awareness is in the dumpster as you are climbing in sports.
I imagine so. Like, I can't speak for everyone, but there wasn't a lot of time for smelling the roses or necessarily evaluating who you are. That didn't come until after my career was over and I realized.
But so many people say, like, so many people would look at what your life has been to now, what they imagine it to be because they're not living it and would say, yeah, those are the dream scenarios. I'm great at sports. I'm great at business.
Good at sex too.
That's uncomfortable.
Sorry.
It took a dark turn.
It was getting a little too deep. I had to curveball it.
You're not doing all those things as sexual terms, are you? I want to do the deep stuff. I want to talk to you about the probing insecurities and vulnerabilities that lead us all toward ambition. But you don't want to do that. You want to make jokes. You want to do the show while we're talking.
Can we just focus on the probing?
I want to talk about the probing. Let's talk about the soul searching. I want to talk about like how you became who you became. Because how do you get to these places and then say, never mind?
It's not even I never mind, and like I am very proud of the life I've led and the things I've accomplished, but I think that we, when we're children and we're young, we have a simple view of the world. And you're like, all right, if I got money, if I got a wife, or if I got a house, then everything is gonna be all right. But I mean, I think we all know, adults will be listening to this, they know that things are more complicated than that. And as you've said before, obviously money is a down payment on happiness. It makes everything so much easier. My life is so much easier because of the means I have access to. But it doesn't eliminate the difficulties that you could face, particularly where it's like it felt like, and it does still kind of feel like this. Like I was in a midlife crisis to some point, which is a rare thing to feel at such a young age. But you are in a real transition where you look back on your life and you're like, all right. It's done. Like everything is done. Now what?
I'm past tense.
Yeah.
I am right. I've done all the achieving. That's it.
Or who you thought you were or who you thought you needed to be to get to where you were. Like that person is no longer useful.
Dominique, I have never met not one athlete who leaves it. Not one. And I've met some deep athletes, some guys that are real introspective, know themselves real well. They all think they're equipped for what it will be to lose your identity as a professional football player, and none of them are. I've yet to meet anyone with the credentials sophisticated enough to leave the gladiator stuff and be like, okay, and now my life is better.
I think it's difficult. I certainly do think that now my life is better than I was when I was a player, but it wasn't without some struggle. And I do think that I was a player who, like, I willingly retired well before I needed to. And it was because I thought I was ready. in a way. And I think that you can't be ready. I was the player who was always considered like the smart guy. And I was like, all right, well, whatever struggles other people are having, I'm not going to have those because I'm the smart athlete. But it's a catastrophic shift in your life, in your way of being.
Robert Smith, man, he's talked about this publicly, so I'm not betraying any confidences, but I helped get him to rehab. And he thought, like, this is a guy who was reputed throughout the country as being the smart athlete, the guy who chose medicine over school and football and stardom. And then he retires early and he thinks he's uniquely equipped to handle this because of his intellect. And next thing he knows, he's drinking all morning and throwing up into a bucket.
I'm smarter than Robert Smith.
Are you?
I mean, the competitive's still there. Get him in here.
Are you? Are you smarter than Robert Smith?
Regardless,
that shit's hard.
No, I'm just joking about that. But I know, and I thought it was going to be easy, and it was not easy. It's something that I think if you're not introspective at all, it's probably easier. But at a certain point where you don't have time to focus on other things, if you aren't chasing, and that's like, you would never say that there's any luxury in living paycheck to paycheck, but there is some guidance in that. And when you are like, all right, why do I have to go to work? And so I quit the MBPA job in part because I was on a subway every morning going to work at 7 a.m. and coming home at like 8 p.m. and not spending time with my kids. And that's an easy thing to justify when you are trying to create a better life for your family. But it wasn't impacting my family's life at all. And then I was like, all right, so then don't do it. And then I was like, so then what do you do? So there is some guidance in scarcity, which no one wants to experience scarcity, but it does clarify. When I was before I made any money, I was like, all right, well, I got to do this because I got to get
that money. What was that realization like, though? You're on the subway and you're thinking to yourself, okay, I'm coming home here at 8 o'clock. I'm running the finances. I'm climbing up the whatever the executive ladder would be, the highest rung for a former athlete. I'm going to get into the money and I'm going to, you know, have arguments with Jerry Jones. I'm going to do all that stuff. And now you're coming home at 8 p.m. You're not seeing your kids who are at this age very, very young.
At this age, I think was 5 and 3 and my wife was pregnant and we were in New York in an apartment and away from our family and she was miserable and I was feeling guilty. And then it's like when you go to work and it's stressful and it's tough, that's fine. If it's for a reason, then you come home and your pregnant wife is exhausted and your kids haven't seen you all day and it's stressful and tough at home too. You're like, for what? For who? Mm-hmm. And so I was like, all right, I'm done.
Do you remember Ricky Waters? Are you,
You're
old enough to remember for what, for who? That was him going across the middle and just alligator arms. They ask him about it after the game. He's like, yeah, why am I going to get crushed over the middle? For what, for who?
Yeah, I know that's where that came from. I know that I never remember Ricky Waters played for the 49ers and the Eagles. Great.
But how old were you then?
I don't know. I was obsessed with football from the time I was a little kid. I don't know if I ever told you this story, but my dad asked me when I was 5 what I wanted to be when I grew up. And I was like, all right, football player. My dad, I don't know if he believed it or not, but he used it as an opportunity to teach me something. And he said, so you set a goal and you should do something, get yourself closer to that goal every day. And I was like, all right, that makes sense. So that night I did crunches and sit-ups, probably a couple hundred of them. And I couldn't control my bowels and was throwing up at 6 years old because I thought. And so then my dad went on to teach me about moderation at that point, which was a good transition.
An important lesson.
Yeah, but at that point, it was like there was nothing more important to me. And I was like, all right. And being naive child is like, oh, so I can just out-sit up everybody my way to the league. And
it's quite the plan. And then you did. And then you set out to do so. That's exactly right. You made a multi-million dollar career after wanting, because you are not, look, I don't mean to diminish your athletic skill, but there are so many people in that league who are monster athletes. And I do not look at you and say, that is the most athletically gifted fast twitch muscle fiber I've seen. So you getting to the league had to almost be a matter of will, did it not?
No, I'm a great athlete. I ran a 4.35, jumped 42 inches at combine. I think it was like my 5 cone. I think I was top 3 in every test at the combine. So kind of a great athlete.
I walked into that one, didn't I?
I'm just saying, Google it.
How much do you weigh, though? You seem like somebody that I could throw around on the floor here pretty easily.
Stop the tape, Mike. Mike, stop the tape.
I'm asking you a question. How much do you weigh?
Stop the
I've got 100 pounds on. Are you 170 tape. Pounds? Are you 170 pounds?
Stop the motherfucking tape, Mike.
I would just lay on you. You're an old man, old and broken.
I am about 175.
You're made of twigs.
I was always the lightest on most of my teams. That is true. But stop the motherfucking tape.
You look like something I'd buy at Rattan Shack.
Don't talk about it. Be about it. You can't whoop me.
You're made of balsa wood.
I'll break everybody in here in the shipping container.
Wait a minute. Why are you fighting? Oh, Chris Cody just stood up, and that's a lot of pale, freckled belly. He will hit you with a shot to the nipples that will make you crumble, Rattan Shack.
I'll eat that.
Is Rattan Shack a thing?
Yeah,
is
I don't know what you're talking about. That's some old people shit.
This is, no.
I was gonna gloss over it.
Hold on a second.
Is that just a Miami thing?
Hold on a second. Help me out, Mike, please. I didn't mean for Rattan the show Shack? To break out in the middle of this conversation, Mike, but I need you guys to all Google search, please. Help me here. I need you to Google search Rattan Shack. See what comes up on the image search. I believe it's called Rattan. I don't know if this is a national thing or just a local thing, but now you've got me obsessed.
Never heard of it.
Okay. Rattan Shack would allow me to make you be made of balsa wood, of twigs, of some sort of bamboo.
I don't know what it is. But anyway, size is a factor. It would be nice. It would have been nicer to be bigger, but I couldn't help that. But I've been hit by a lot of big guys and I was fine. The worst hit I ever took was from a small guy, Eddie Royal. Got a crackback block on me, hit me in the chest. And I got up and was coughing blood. I thought about going to the sideline, but again, it was my contract year. And I was like, nope, we're going to go ahead and play this one out. So the blood stopped. It was fine.
You're coughing blood?
Yeah, it's a little bit of blood.
Well, you've been funny recently talking about the idea of when you stand on an NFL sideline, you're like, what the fuck was I doing? I shouldn't have been doing this. This is crazy. Everyone's moving too fast. Everyone's made of granite.
It was probably a year after I stopped playing, I was down on the sideline for a game. I was like, what in the world is this? People do this? How? It just doesn't make sense. And anyone who's been on the sideline, I think you've been on the sideline during the game.
No, before. It's terrifying.
Yeah, it's terrifying. It does not, you don't realize it when you're out there running around. It doesn't feel like it's that fast, but when you're on the sideline, it's just.
No, it is like a storm that moves faster than any human beings you know. You're just sitting there. You're like, oh, is that a 3-yard sweep to the left side? Look out here. Old people, linesmen, everyone's getting knocked out. Be careful. These people have working out all their lives to get to this moment when they're taking out your ankle.
I mean, watching the games and seeing how many people get hit when the play comes to the sideline is evidence of how fast the game is moving. Because the actual athletes who are over there cannot get out of the way.
Right. Can't get out of the way because the field is too small for all of their athleticism. Mike Ryan is about to break in here with some important Rattan Shack information that I'm sure is going to embarrass me.
All right. So there's only one Rattan Shack and it's in Hialeah, Florida. However, they do specialize in wicker.
Thank you. Thank you. That is great. It is a confirmation that it was an obscure reference, but an accurate one.
They specialize in what?
Wicker.
Watch your mouth, Dan.
You're made of wicker.
What'd you call me?
Can you define wicker for me, please, Roy? Can you look up
the, oh, why Roy got to define wicker?
The definition.
Why can't Mike look up wicker?
Because Roy's closer to the computer.
Chris, you look up wicker.
I don't know what you mean by this. Chris is far away from the computer.
Wicker, please.
So Roy is looking this up, and Roy is going to find this, and he's going to give us a definition of for wicker, which is what I have alleged, that Dominique Foxworth is not an athlete. He is not made of muscles and wires. I would beat him up because he is made of wicker you can find at Rattan Shack. Roy, what is wicker?
A slender, pliant twig.
keep talking trash.
Well, so the reference was perfect.
It was not perfect.
Yes, because you look like, how much do you weigh, Dominique?
About 178, maybe, with some rocks.
100 pounds of blubber would be undulating over you with great deals of difficulty getting it off of you.
Keep talking trash. I have all my wickers out here.
Where is your pain threshold compared to the normal human being? I'm dead serious about this. Like the average human being, I believe, on a football Monday or Tuesday, even for cornerbacks, would not want to get up and go to work. Would not want to get out of bed.
No, I mean you're right. Yeah, it's something that's hard to explain. But I guess you feel like if you feel like you've ever had the flu, you know how that feels. You put that. I think that is like the base of
that's
it.
That's
like,
how you go. Yeah. 16 weeks a year or 20 weeks a year, I'm going to feel like I have the flu.
On Monday morning, you feel like you have the flu and it doesn't get much better until later in the week. And you just start to move and you get, it's about expectations. It's a funny thing is people can live up to those expectations. So the expectation in football is you're going to feel like that. The expectation is you're going to practice feeling like that. You're going to play feeling like that and you get used to it. And I didn't realize until after I got out of the league how many guys were like just medicating to get through the week. And I'm kind of a square in general when it comes to medication, but I had one Toradol shot in my career before a championship game, a conference championship game, because I just didn't feel good in my shoulder and my hip. But there are guys who are getting that every day before practice and before every game. And
that's terrible on like your kidneys and stuff, your organs.
Got to be awful.
And so what? You realized that when? Like when?
I just realized it after when I was talking to guys who had retired and they were like happy that they were no longer taking that stuff. And I was like, oh yeah, it was rough. And I would tell them like about the one time I took it and they were like, oh yeah, I had like 40 times a season. Like what? That can't be good for you. But I guess you could understand how you rationalize that because there's nothing more important to those guys than winning. And I understand being there. I'm not judging them. I didn't realize it was an option necessarily. I might have done the same thing if I thought that it could make me play better. And I'm sure the same is probably true for performance enhancing drugs is how much I'm sure a lot more of that was taking place than I was willing to admit. I would have told you that there was a small percentage, not very many, probably all guys were caught when I was a player. And now,
well,
I'm
you sound
older
like a real sucker, Dominique. Like it sounds like you have these epiphanies walking through sports. You're sitting there and the coaches have Cadillacs and you're like, wait a minute, I've been an idiot. And then like, what is, like you're walking around and you come to these moments of clarity.
Yeah. I mean, I just thought that they were tough. I mean, they are tough, but I didn't think I would see guys limping around and go out on the field and play and seem like they weren't limping around. And I would be like, oh yeah, I'm doing the same thing. I'm limping around too. Then I go out there and show up and play. I didn't realize that guys were actually using other things. So yeah, I'm a sucker. I'm not as smart as I think or as you think I think I am.
Well, what is that about though? Like seriously, how do you get to the league and you're such a square? You're so Andrew Luck. I don't even know. Explain this to me. How do you get from what you came from to being a square in the league who is dedicated to squareness?
I never had to be cool because I was a good athlete. So that made me cool. So once I was a good athlete, all the things that I did that were corny in my high school, all of a sudden were the cool things to do. And so like it was whatever peer pressure there was for people to like smoke or drink or whatever. I didn't face those because I didn't have to convince anybody that I was cool. I didn't have to convince anybody that I was like more mature than I actually was because I was the best football player any of them had ever seen.
Sports becomes a great confidence boost, right? Awesome. Like it makes childhood so much easier to be great at sports.
Oh, it does. I think that it makes adulthood better, not even to be great at sports, but just to have your thing. And I think that's where most fans could relate to the idea of losing your identity. Cause I think it was, it's James Baldwin, I think, talks about how everyone kind of black men specifically in a neighborhood had to have like their racket, like that was your thing and you were the guy who did X or you were the, for him, it was the church boy. Like he was the guy who was in church all the time. And I think all of us have something that is like our thing. You were a writer and are a writer and journalist. And I think all of us have something that we can grab onto. Imagine that it was taken away from you.
And in your late 20s or early 30s.
Like, and you are gone through your entire life with this thing. It's like, yeah, I'm that guy. And then you're not that guy anymore. It's a tough thing to, deal with.
Well, that when I was doing that stuff with Robert Smith, we had a lot of conversations about the idea of you start referring to yourself in the past tense, who you were. I used to play for the Vikings. Yeah. And you start what you end up doing is just you are grieving the burying of that human being because that human being will never be allowed to exist in the real world. He's only allowed to live in football land.
That is interesting that we do talk about it in the past tense, like that person is dead. But I mean, to some degree, the person is dead. I'm not the person that I was then, which I think is healthier. If I was still that football player trying to go through life, it'd be pretty hard. And when those glimpses of that person pop back up in my mind, I realized. So one of the first things when I first started working at ESPN that I realized was people are fragile, like emotionally fragile as hell.
You realize that. See, I've had this conversation. Dominique, I've had this
You're
conversation.
So
listen
soft.
To me. I have listened. Listen to me. I have listened to Jalen Rose, Marcellus Wiley. I have talked to them being on the campus of ESPN. And because they come from locker rooms, and it's not just these two, I have talked to a dozen athletes who say what I think Dominique's about to tell you, which is our media business is so much more insecure than the world that you guys come from, that the Ryan Clarks of the world look around our newsroom and they're like, how is it possible that these people are this much into their feeling?
It's not right or wrong. It's just weird. And people around the talent, so to speak, behave like they're so fragile. And we come from a world where you go out there and you play bad sometimes and people tell you you suck. Your coach will put your film up in front of the entire team on Monday morning after you lost and watch
you. I should start doing that around here.
And watch you, and the whole team will watch you get cooked. And you just have to deal with it.
You then, not doing your job. Well, right. Failure is such a routine part of the job. Public failure is such a routine part of the job, especially your job,
yeah.
Which is like this microscopic fight over inches of space with, God, your job is terrible.
Then you go to the mall after you gave up a game-winning touchdown. You're like, yeah, that's a world that you live in. And so now when I first started here, and I'm still trying to get better at this, I would ask producers, like, so what can I work on? And they're like, oh, it's great. I'm like, I know it's not great. This is my third day. Like, oh, it's great. And I would never get any constructive criticism. I have to go to other people like you who will actually listen to something or watch something and tell me that something sucks or to work on.
I found that part interesting about you. It surprised me because, of course you would crave coaching. Coaching helped raise you, helped shape you, helped make you the things that you are. But yes, ESPN expects you to get to ESPN and know how to do your job.
It's not even that they expect it. They know that some people suck, but they don't want to help the people who suck because they're scared to hurt their feelings. And it drives me crazy because then it makes me feel like I can't tell somebody else when they suck.
Well, that's the other thing about the locker room that's not normal. The way you talk to people in the locker room is not the way human resources is not.
Nah.
It's not okay with the way that you talk to people in the locker room.
The locker room is an HR free zone. For the better and for worse. There's some really awful things. I told a HR story once on the air and it didn't go over well.
What happened?
You remember when I was on SportsCenter? I haven't been on since.
No, you were banned for a sex toy. Oh, the
right,
sex
yeah.
toy joke.
It wasn't a joke, actually. It was a true story about something that took place in our locker room. That's outrageous that something that takes place in a sports locker room will get you in trouble on a sports show. But, I mean, I understood what happened there.
Well, no, wait a minute. Because you kept saying the name of the sex toy again and again, and you knew what you were doing, and that's the joke that got you suspended. What was the sex toy?
Fleshlight. Can we say that on here? Are we going to get in trouble again?
That was that part where you said, I might get fired for this, but whatever, I don't need this job.
That is exactly right. Yes, that is when you got banned from SportsCenter. It's interesting the way Dominique remembers that so much differently than it actually happened. Yeah,
I'm not mad. I deserve the banning, but I mean,
that is something you decided to say on ESPN's air. I might get fired for this, but what do I care? I don't need this job. It is flippant arrogance, unlike ever in the history of the company on air.
I was in a rough place. Remember, feel sorry for me. I was transitioning, losing my identity. Remember,
while people were getting laid off at the company, you're like, I don't need this job. It was weird to see your face of all the faces be the face of entitlement at the company.
I had to send Skipper a message. Let him know. I ain't scared of you.
I want to cover some of these misconceptions that you've had clarified for you, where you have these moments of epiphany. You were sitting across from Jerry Jones in a negotiation, and you came to the realization while sitting there, this human being is not smarter than me. He is just someone who has made a lot of money at whatever is his business is.
Yeah, I don't mean it to be like an insult necessarily. It was just a real revelation that I had, and I think growing up in Baltimore County, it's like going to public schools. You imagine that people like Bill Gates, people who got billions of dollars, and it's probably true for Bill Gates, but you think that all billionaires have gotten there because they've just outsmarted everyone, which as an adult, I realize it's not true. Like, it's a lot of luck, happenstance, and it's hard work. It's serendipity and commitment. It's not to say that they don't deserve what they've gotten, but the idea that they are just like, and this is very obviously from an athlete's point of view, because better athletes make it further. So I think smarter people make it further. And then I'm sitting there like, no.
So you are at this point are not analyzing America, America's history, how money comes from inheritance, where, you know, black people have been held back by all manner of history. You're not examining any of that at that point. You're thinking Jerry Jones just is smarter about where to find oil and how to make giant businesses than I am.
It's not just Jerry. It's all of the owners. And it wasn't even like the race part of it wasn't even necessarily matter. I would have assumed that even if we factor in like institutional racism and like non-institutional racism, I would have assumed that he was smarter than all white people. Like that the reason why you got there, the reason why you win a championship is because you're the best team. The reason why you are a billionaire is because you're the best at business. And Jerry Jones and all of them are very talented at certain things. But I assumed that the idea that I would go to Harvard Business School, if you would have told me that before I started participating in CBA negotiations, I would have been like, no, those guys are geniuses. And then I was like, oh, no. They're not. They work hard and they've gotten lucky. And I am capable of that if I focus on that the way that I focused on football.
Well, when did your racial view of the world, because it sounds like you were pretty sheltered by whatever it was, you know, just the pursuit of excellence, the focus that athleticism requires. When did you realize, just like you realized with the Cadillacs, oh, the coaches are making money off of our body. When did you start thinking about the racial components, how they were infecting, how you were covered, everything else?
I don't ever remember not. Like, that's the interesting thing. And I think that's a credit to my parents. And I went to a high school. I went to a magnet school that was not my local school. And that school was probably 50-50 on race. My elementary school, my middle school were like 90% black. So when you are in that environment, it's easy for you to not necessarily think about the world outside. But my parents made me aware of things that were going on. So like, I am black before I'm anything else, I feel like, in this world. And it's not necessarily my choice. My experience is more black than it is male, if that makes sense. My experience is more black than it is football player or millionaire or any of those things. Like, before anything else in my life, I feel like other people and my experience is more black than anything. So it's hard for me to separate that. So I don't ever remember not being aware of those things.
So that you were never naive about. Like, you could be naive about these other things. You could not know much of anything on these big subjects. But on this subject, that was something that you saw from the very beginning.
My parents. Like, it's something, and I imagine that lots of black people are listening, understand this, and maybe people from other races, and maybe even women understand this, is that people tell you that from the time that you start. It's like, you're a black man, you're going to have to do twice as good. This world is not designed for you. And then you have experiences where you realize, like, I got pulled over when I got a driver's license and ended up with four squad cars and they made me get out. It was broad daylight coming home from the mall. And I was like,
no, but it's because you're a big threat as a man who's made of wicker.
We're actually literally going to fight. It was funny. It was all for the show at one point, but this, we're fighting, Dan.
I'm sorry. You were about to tell a story about life-changing racial moment in which you realized how divided America is with the excess of police force on your, what were you speeding, you said, or what were you doing?
I don't know what we were doing. Maybe that would change the story, huh? So, I mean, I just crossed the median and, you know, just was driving willy-nilly, shot some gunshots out the window. And how dare these officers come with four squad cars? No, none of that is true. But I mean, it's not a crazy interesting story. It's just like, it's something that people understand and people experience. Right before I got drafted, I was at a Super Bowl party. So I was prepping for the combine. So I wasn't home. So I went to the trainer, invited me to his friend's house for a Super Bowl party. I'm at a Super Bowl party. It's me and offensive lineman from my school, who's big dude. We're the only black guys at the Super Bowl party. The trainer is white. We were in New York, of all places. Not like we were in Alabama somewhere. It was the Eagles versus the Patriots, and T.O. caught a ball but didn't get the first down. Apparently the guy had money on the Eagles and yelled at T.O. through the screen, "You f***er." And I'm sitting there with my 6'8 offensive lineman, who's also black and from Georgia, and it's a room full of white guys, and the room goes silent. And it's, I think then everything starts going through my mind, like, what is my obligation? What am I supposed to do? Everyone's waiting for me to react. And I'm like, all right, so I gotta now beat up a whole room of gym rats. Like, is this now my move? Like, no. So I just stood up and walked out. And I remember thinking, as me and my teammate were driving back to the hotel, like, I remember feeling some guilt and some shame because I wasn't angry. And so it's something that I had to unpack. It took me a while to unpack, but I realized, like, I don't respect them. And it didn't bother me. Like, I thought it was, like, stupid of them. But I realized that, like, I would have been upset if they were people that I, like, cared about or had some respect for. But I was like, I don't know. It was a weird situation.
So you felt guilt about not being more hurt?
Yeah, I felt guilt.
Of not caring at all
it wasn't even that I didn't care, but I felt guilt that I wasn't filled up with rage. Because I was like, I should probably punch somebody now. Like, that's what's supposed
to happen. Well, that would be the way to handle it.
Yeah, I mean, you got to teach them a lesson, right?
Right.
I don't know. I just didn't feel it was a weird thing. I'm not even sure that it's relevant to anything that we're talking about, but it popped up in my mind.
It really isn't. It was just a couple of racial incidents that you have, you have endured. I was talking more about, like, if you ever watched television, if you're turning on the television as you're becoming a college and pro athlete and you're watching the way things are covered and you're like, this isn't my perspective. This is not my viewpoint.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that happens all the time. And just the idea of me going through the world as a black person more than anything else. Like, one of my favorite things to do was to go to car dealerships or to fancy stores and experience the same experience that happened all the time, where they would dismiss me or treat me poorly. And then one guy or one person would recognize that I played for the Broncos or whatever, and then watch the shift.
You'd do it for fun? You'd go shopping just to do that, just to watch the shift.
The shift was amazing.
Yeah. Once they realize that you have money.
Yeah, but it goes from a security guard following me around to a salesperson following me around. It's a great shift.
Yes, it is. You see how, you can see for yourself how overtly money changes everything.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm sure it's just more money than it is race, but it was always fun. Or I'm actually probably not sure of that, actually.
Fun is a weird thing, though. Fun for you to do that for fun. How many times would you do that? Like, you'd do that with no intention of buying anything? You'd just be a Bronco giving off the whiff of wealth at jewelry stores?
I didn't buy much jewelry, but I bought a car or two. I would buy stuff.
Were you reckless?
No. Come on.
You don't do any reckless, dude. What's the last incredibly reckless thing that you did?
Played in the NFL?
Yeah, but you don't do – well, that's true, but you didn't think it was reckless. No, because you didn't think there were consequences. You're an idiot. You play in the NFL, but you didn't know that what you were doing was reckless. I don't know how you didn't know what you were doing was reckless. That seems totally incongruous.
I mean, it's about, like, culture, I think. It's like, you grew up in a culture. I'm sure we can go to a bunch of different cultures and find things that people do that are dangerous and reckless, that we would view as dangerous and reckless, and probably the same thing for us. But you grow up and you think it's normal. Once I left that culture, I started to realize, oh, that was really stupid. And like, that not only was what happened on the field like reckless for my body, but like, as a goal in life, it's reckless. Because at every turn that you take a step further in football, you are closing off many other professional doors. And I realized it after I got to the NFL, and a few years later, I kind of reconnect with some college friends, and they're in bad shape. They're smart guys, but they're in bad shape because while other students were getting internships or focusing on a major that they cared about or a major with some professional future, they were taking a major that allowed them to focus on football, and they were working out throughout the summer to focus on football. And then all of a sudden, you got a bachelor's degree, which isn't worth what it used to be, and no experience, no connections, no plan. It's tough.
That was depressing at the end. Can we have a better ending to this than that?
I had a lot of fun in college. All the girls liked us.
You want to tell those stories? You want to tell the stories about being popular in college? Or just, actually, you probably got a pretty good story without it betraying any confidences that would embarrass anybody in your family. You probably got some pretty good stories about being shocked by things that were happening in the pros when it came to whether it's womanizing or just some of the nonsense that probably wasn't available in college before there was money.
Oh, sure. So my first experience, everyone asks for like your welcome to the NFL moment. They expect you to like have been embarrassed on the field or something by a vet. But no, mine was the first weekend I was there. We practiced for a couple of days, and then one of the vets had a pool party. I go to the pool party. Trying to be a nice guy, I go to the liquor store and buy a big bottle of something. It's like, you don't go to a party empty-handed. I show up. The teammate opens the door and looks at me like I'm stupid for bringing a bottle. I'm like, but I wanted to. He's like, all right, thanks, whatever, put it over there. And I walk in, and there are young ladies with just bottoms on running in and out of the house to the pool. There is a pool table in the basement that I don't know how much money was on it, but there were probably over $100,000 of money on the table. People were playing craps. There was a glass table that had some young ladies taking part in a white powdery substance, as they say. And there was later on in the night, I went into the bathroom and there were some people enjoying each other in the bathroom. And I just remember thinking, oh, it is really like this. Like all the movies and all the cliches that you thought. Yeah, yeah, they're real. Obviously, that it wasn't like that every weekend, but I was shocked to see that it is kind of nuts.
When did Mike Shanahan send everybody home?
That's a much better ending than the one we had that was depressing before. We'll end on that note. Thank you for spending time with us, Dominique. I'm glad that the audience got to know you a little bit better. Thanks to Dominique Foxworth for tolerating our nonsense. I actually said that an NFL cornerback wasn't that athletic. That's a thing that I said. Next week, we hope to have Action Bronson if he's not too high.